You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Brookings. I'm Mike O'Hanlon with the Foreign Policy Program. And I again have the distinct privilege on behalf of all of us at Brookings of welcoming you to an event where we collaborate with the Wounded Warrior Project, one of the great organizations in the United States taking care of our battle heroes. And today we have, I think, a very good program for you that many of you have seen now on the announcement. And thank you for coming. We will begin shortly with a video prepared by the Wounded Warrior Project that summarizes their recent activities and also a bit about their annual survey, which is providing the jumping-off point for our discussion today, in which they've talked to, I believe, 30,000-plus of their membership through this survey technique to figure out what is on their mind, what is going well in their lives, what is still challenging, where they are being well-served, whether by the government or NGOs or their communities or job opportunities, where there are still big problems that we should, as a nation, be trying to address, and that the Wounded Warrior Project is doing its own large part to address as well. So we'll begin with that video, and then we'll have a discussion, and I'm going to be privileged to have this discussion with Jen Silva and Melanie Musso of the Wounded Warrior Project, who specialize in the programmatic activities and in the metrics, respectively, for that organization. We're going to talk about the survey, understand a bit about how it was done, who it represents. This is primarily wounded or ill veterans, so it's a subset of the broader population that has served in uniform, but it's obviously a subset we all can and do and must care about greatly, because many of these people, of course, have borne great sacrifice and burden as a result of their combat experience or other parts of their military experience. So we will begin with the video, we will then have a discussion, and then we'll go until about 2:45, if that's okay. We'll hear from Dr. Paul Lawrence and Dr. Caroline Clancy, who were both important representatives of the government who are working hard on this set of issues from the federal perspective. So we'll get views across the private and NGO and public sector, and look forward in the course of a number of parts of the program to your questions and interventions as well. So, without further ado, I think I'll ask that we play the video, and then maybe at that point we can give a round of applause, because the video will be a nice way to give me a chance to thank Wounded Warrior Project and all the veterans that it represents, and then we'll go to our discussion. So thanks again for being here, and please play the video.
For the last 10 years, Wounded Warrior Project has conducted the annual Warrior Survey to uncover the most pressing needs of the warriors we serve and act upon them. The data informs all Wounded Warrior Project programs and legislative efforts and gives warriors a platform to be heard by individuals and organizations who can initiate change. The 2019 survey boasts the highest number of participants in its 10-year history, making it the largest, most statistically relevant survey of its kind. The survey provides an extensive 360-degree view of this generation of veterans. These are the warriors we serve. The most common injuries and health problems sustained by warriors include back, neck, or shoulder problems, and sleep problems, and mental health issues, including PTSD, depression, and anxiety. Over 30% of warriors report difficulty getting mental health care, and even more are struggling to get care for their physical injuries. These barriers to care have persisted over the last 10 years, continuously standing between warriors and the care they deserve. The stigmas surrounding mental health create additional barriers specific to mental health care. However, the majority of warriors are seeking help for their mental health concerns in multiple ways, relying most heavily on VA medical centers, talking with post-9/11 veterans, and prescription medication. The majority of warriors receive benefits and health care coverage through the VA. While we've seen improvement over the years, the Warrior unemployment rate is still a major concern, at more than 3 times the national average. And despite the unique strengths they bring to the workforce, many Warriors cite issues like mental health and lack of qualification as barriers to employment. To help combat unemployment, many Warriors are equipping themselves with education. The following are critical findings from the 2019 Annual Warrior Survey. 70% of Warriors were exposed to toxic substances or hazardous chemicals during their military service, yet only 9% have received treatment for it at the VA. 44% of female Warriors experienced military sexual trauma. 33% of Warriors reported having thoughts related to suicide in the past 2 weeks. These statistics are more than just numbers. They represent the hardships faced by countless Warriors every day. We share their stories to ensure their voice never falls silent and to urge action by individuals who have the power to initiate change. Wounded Warrior Project empowers Warriors to live a life worth living. Because every Warrior deserves a positive future to look forward to. When they're ready to start their next mission in life, we stand ready to serve.
Well, that was a fantastic video, and it's amazing work what you folks are doing. So let me just start by complimenting you both and your whole organization. And I also want to give a shout out to General Linnington and to my good friend Joe Plensler and so many other people with the project. I wondered if we could begin first, and I guess, Jen, I'll just ask you to tell us a little more about who responded to the survey and who's represented within the broader Wounded Warrior Project community, and also specifically who we're talking about in terms of the people who have given us these kinds of important feedback data points.
Great. So Wounded Warrior Project, we serve those that are wounded, injured, or ill due to their post 9/11 service. So if you can think about the post 9/11 generation, these are the warriors who have injuries as a result of their service. So in slightly more at risk in terms of visible and invisible wounds. And so our programs really focus on offering a breadth of services in mental health, physical health, in employment, keeping them connected, because we believe that our model can help them wherever they are on that spectrum in their continuum of care.
So it's remarkable. You said there are more than 130,000 former servicemen and women who are part of your broader community. That's an incredibly large population and percentage. I think that you were saying before the number of those who have deployed is very high to a combat zone. But about half of that population was technically wounded during one of those deployments. The other half got hurt somewhere else or got sick in the course of their career. Is that roughly correct?
That's roughly correct, yeah.
So you're an NGO that manages to basically have everybody participating. Almost everyone who has been wounded or ill wants to be part of the Wounded Warrior Project in some way, and about a third, or I guess a quarter roughly, have taken your survey, which is, again, an incredibly high percentage.
Right. We're really proud of the warriors who take the survey year over year for the last 10 years, and the response rate has hovered above 30% since the beginning, and then all the way up to 50 1 year. But they feel like this is a great way to tell us what their challenges are, what some of their victories are, and we really take that seriously, and we pledge to be their voice, whether it's through our advocacy efforts and through our program development.
And I'm glad you said that, because we'll come back to you in a little bit to talk about everything Wounded Warrior Project does with this information to try to help the lives of those affected. But Melanie, if now we could talk a little bit about the survey itself, and I know we want to get into a few specifics and some trends over the years, but let me begin even with a broader question, which is, when you look at these numbers and these results, do you find yourself more encouraged or more discouraged by the challenges that remain?
I think it's a nice balance between the two. I think, as you saw in the video, there are certainly some startling statistics from the 33% of warriors that report having thoughts related to suicide in the last 2 weeks. I don't know how you couldn't be surprised by that number. But on the flip side, there is also encouragement and hope, because we see the stories of those warriors that are able to overcome those challenges and adversity, and those numbers are reflected with the number of warriors who have gone on and persisted through adversity and hardship to go on and achieve advanced degrees. This year, we're just under 40% that have earned a bachelor's degree or higher, and we have another 20% that are currently enrolled in school. So I think that's a good news story. So I think it's important when we look at these findings, it sheds a light on the seriousness of the issues that those that are registered with us. So as Jen mentioned, and you mentioned as well, those are the ones that have been wounded, injured, or ill as a result of their service post 9/11, that they have a number of obstacles to overcome, but we're also seeing that those obstacles are being overcome and they're learning to live successful and productive lives despite that.
So we can bear down on a couple of specific categories or areas, starting with education. You mentioned that 40% have a bachelor's degree or more at this point. How does that number compare with previous years? How's the trend looking?
Absolutely. That's one of the bright spots. We've seen it increase almost 16% over the 10 years that we've taken the survey. So year over year, we're seeing more warriors pursuing as well as then attaining those degrees. So it's not just about going back to school, but they're seeing it through to the end to actually earn those diplomas. And then that translates to the uptick that we've seen in unemployment rates declining. This year, we're at 11.5%. Certainly, as you saw in the video, that is still significantly higher than the general population. But again, considering the population that we serve and the significant decline over the last 10 years, at one point we were hovering around the 20% rate. So that's another good news story.
As you said, the typical person responding, I mean, there is no typical, everyone's got their own challenges, but the typical person, at the average disability rating might be in the range of 60 to 80%, right?
Absolutely.
So these are people with serious injuries and challenges.
Yes, we've got a third of the population is at 100% disabled. So, yes.
The 11.5%, that's when we talk about an unemployment rate, that's the percent of those who are looking for work who are not able to find work. And then there are a lot of other people who simply aren't necessarily in a position to look right now.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think that was more like a third of the group, a third of the broader group was not able to look for work right now. Is that roughly correct?
And the labor force participation rate has decreased over the years for various reasons, such as retirement, inability to work, et cetera.
Yeah, and your average age has gone up partly because most of the people who got hurt in these wars got hurt sort of in the 2000s or the early 2010s. We have a smaller population deploying now. I wanted to ask a little bit also about healthcare and understand these figures a little bit more too. And of course, this will set up the conversation with Jen in a minute about areas where policy still needs to respond and where you're doing so much with the project, but also where the federal government and the rest of us might need to do more. You talked about the issue of VA becoming more the go-to place than it had been 5 years ago. Is that a good news story? Has the CHOICE Act helped? Is it good for people to have the option of going to the private sector? Has that put some competitive pressure on the VA? Has the VA made useful reforms that have now just made the whole enterprise more accessible and inviting to veterans? How do you understand that data?
Sure. I'll tackle part of that from the data perspective. And we've seen that the VA is consistently in the top three choices for warriors who are dealing with their mental health care. But one area where we have seen the growth is that health care in general, that 70% of warriors are entitled to the VA health care benefits. And we've seen this year top out at 70% that are choosing to use that as their primary health care resource. The reasons that they're doing it is there's a sense of entitlement that they've earned those benefits, and therefore they're going to seek their support from the VA. But on the flip side, there is still hesitation amongst that 30% that aren't making that choice regarding the quality of care, perhaps being perceived that it could be better elsewhere or having a previous negative experience. But I'll defer to Jen to talk a little bit more about the implications related to policy.
Yeah, please go ahead.
Great. We are focusing on what the warriors tell us year over year the biggest challenges are for accessing care. Scheduling conflicts, so having a more innovative approach to hours of availability would be very helpful for the veterans that we hear from. Ensuring that there's a connection with the providers. A lot of times they have to use multiple providers for referrals, et cetera, and so the more that the care can be streamlined and with one or fewer providers, that's helpful for our warriors as to what if they're going to access that care. And we all believe that access to the VA healthcare system is very important for our warriors, whether it's in physical health care or mental health care.
But do you, if I could just push on that a little bit, because we've had discussions here over the years at Brookings about the whole idea of a private option for veterans and, you know, the various concepts that gave rise to legislation that made that more feasible. And I wonder if you have in mind a goal for what percentage of the population you would like to see using the VA. I mean, is it maybe okay if there's a little bit of a competitive mix and some who do go to the private sector, and that maybe allows for not only, you know, competition to play a role, but also for both sides to try to learn from the other? Or do you really envision a world in which most veterans, or almost all veterans, would ideally get their health care and their mental health care through the VA system?
Well, we actually believe that what's best for the veteran is dependent on that situation. So the ability to choose is important for veterans. We have our program called Warrior Care Network, where it's a partnership with the VA and also private academic medical centers, four of them across the country at UCLA, Rush, Emory, and Mass General up in Boston. But we also have full-time VA partners on site so they can help with the continuation of care for these warriors, getting the proper medical records, and then follow-on care back at the VA. Innovative partnerships like that, to me, are very critical for the warriors of this generation that we serve.
By the way, on that point, you mentioned records, and I think in the past there have been some big challenges in people sort of transitioning from active duty to the veterans healthcare system and computers not talking to each other and so forth. Is that situation much improved these days?
From what we see, we also have a program that focuses on filing the benefits claims for our veterans, and that process has become much better.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit, Jen, about education and what's responsible for the progress and, you know, the GI Bill and other things I'm assuming are going to be part of the story. And then what else still needs to be done to make appropriate education more accessible to more veterans? And if you have ideas, whether within the Wounded Warrior Project family or for federal policy, suggestions that you think we all should be considering.
Well, we're very pleased about the progress of the warriors we serve in terms of education. And Melanie mentioned that. Having the ability to use the GI Bill and then voc rehab when appropriate for those that have injuries that are kind of forcing them to choose a different path, it's a really comprehensive program that fewer of our warriors use that than the GI Bill. But just access to those federal benefits and the ease of access both on campus for that process to be streamlined, we found is very important. And recognizing those centers of excellence, the universities that really have great programs, is something that we help our veterans find.
I wanted to ask also about, for a veteran who's got some serious mental health issues in particular, maybe having trouble navigating this universe of benefits, employment opportunities, educational opportunities, is there sort of the equivalent of a Sherpa or, you know, a mentor for that kind of a person that is becoming more and more available in larger numbers and maybe, you know, improve quality over the years? How does that kind of a person who's, you know, come out of uniform, is hurt, maybe is confused a little bit, having a hard time really getting his or her feet on the ground, how do they make sense of it all, and who's there to help them?
That's a really great question, and we find that our warriors that we serve usually try and do it alone, and on their own they get out of service and they're trying to navigate whether it's benefits or education or the job search on their own. And for example, in the job search area, or we find the rates of satisfaction with employment in organizations and companies that have veterans councils or employment groups that are focused on veterans, they are much more satisfied than if they go to an organization that doesn't have those groups. And so there's a great way to help that warrior as they're a new civilian employee, having others who have already navigated that. They can be their Sherpas in the employment space. Transitions are really important for, especially for the wounded, injured, or ill, and that's where we see they are most at risk for mental health challenges, substance use, et cetera. And so we focus on managing the really complex cases, and there are several groups that do that. And that kind of the network of support for veterans in cities and then across the country is really important. Wounded Warrior Project is big, but we feel it's one of our strategic priorities to make sure that we're connected and support lots of different groups that focus on veterans in transition, because we can't do it alone, the veteran can't do it alone, or, you know, different organizations can't. So we've got to all work together and collaborate, and that really provides a good kind of safety net for these veterans while they're transitioning.
So that function is not provided so much by the federal government. It's more provided by this network of NGOs, of which you're an important part, trying to figure out how to be responsive to need and being entrepreneurial.
Correct.
This is great, and I've obviously had the luxury of asking you a lot of questions, and I really appreciate the information. I'm sure a lot of others want to get into the conversation, so why don't we now go to that? And we've got about 25, 30 minutes before we take a quick break prior to Dr. Lawrence's remarks. So please, when you get the microphone, identify yourself, and we look forward to your questions and thoughts. Anybody wish to begin? We'll go here in the fourth row, please, Adam.
Good afternoon. I'm Bruce Shalbus. I'm with the College Board. I'm the Senior Director for Military Initiatives. Three-part question, all related to education. First part is, I noticed that student debt is increasing at the same time, which makes me concerned that perhaps predatory schools are influencing decisions on how they use their benefits. Do you have any more information on why student debt is going up as rapidly as it is? Second, I worry about caretaker education. Do you have any evidence that spouses and children are foregoing or delaying their educational attainment while they're serving as caregivers? And then my third question is, what is it that College Board can do in our position to assist in those areas? Thank you.
Thank you.
If I could just start with just a point of clarification, because you're absolutely right. Student loan debt is important. It's something that we need to continue to keep an eye on. We've actually seen the percentage of individuals that are carrying student loan debt, that percentage come down. However, the magnitude of the debt for those students that are carrying it, we have about a third that are in excess of $30,000. So just to frame that up, so the number carrying it is decreasing, but that magnitude of those that are. So I think it feeds very much into your point regarding are there other factors playing. From a data perspective in our survey, we haven't looked specifically at the institutions that they have incurred that debt with, whether they be community colleges, other local universities, or others that subscribe to a different model of education. So I can't speak to that from a data perspective. Jen, anything you want to add to that?
We work with organizations that's their full focus. Student Veterans of America, as I'm sure you know about, we work with them to really gain a lot of insights from the veterans on campus. We know why some students may use that, whether it's flexibility or whatever the case may be, or maybe they're talking with those people and that works out. Sometimes it can be a great model for them due to the flexibility, but we try and empower the veterans with knowledge about the different opportunities and to make sure that they're a an experienced consumer of information from whether it's a junior college or different business models. So I will say that's kind of our approach at Wounded Warrior Project, to empower them with as much information as possible. I would say to what the College Board could do specifically, listen and learn about and follow the veterans who are utilizing your services and on campuses, just and ask organizations who work with them extensively about what the challenges are in terms of what the College Board does. It's just listen and learn and act with however we can make it lower the barriers to entry. Making that college classroom a welcoming environment is really critical. We have developed programs that help with that, to make the 25-year-old veteran sitting next to a maybe 19-year-old freshman as welcoming as possible. So, and then the caretaker part, that's something that we help with, making sure that those caregivers have the time to pursue their own goals. We have a program called the Independence Program, where it focuses on warriors that are, they have traumatic brain injuries or other neurological conditions, spinal cord injuries, et cetera, and require a tremendous amount of caregiving, 40 plus hours per week. We work with the VA, but we go beyond that and provide alternative therapies and respite care for those caregivers so they can go out and pursue their goals, whether it's related to education, maybe they want to a job to provide income for that family. Flexibility is really critical for that. Flexible class hours and those types of things, advocating for that would help that subgroup of people that we care deeply about.
If I could take the prerogative of following up on the education subject with one more question. I think the 40% number is quite striking and quite impressive, and I think higher than the general population, if I'm not mistaken. But of course, we also know that in the United States, there's a discussion about what's the proper balance across the society between college and vocational school or community college? And there's a lot of talk in the presidential races recently about making community college free. I happen to think the more important question is, how do we make community college better? And how do we tie it to local job markets? And I'm wondering, among your general community and membership, do you see people feeling like they have good options within the vocational and community college realm? Are people sort of sometimes going to four-year colleges just because it's what is expected, but it may not be optimal for them? Anything you can say about vocational and community colleges, I'd be curious to hear.
We're very passionate about the vocational side in those opportunities. A lot of the skills that our warriors bring from the military translate very, very well to that that side of the house, and there are a lot of jobs in that market. So we try and coach our warriors to kind of go where the jobs are. And one area that we focused on is the IT industry or IT training of that. And so we work with CompTIA and Cognizant, who are big players in that area, to make sure that they can try their services and the education there and become, at one point there was a 0% unemployment rate in IT jobs. Go there. And, get comfortable with technology. And so we've been coaching our warriors and getting them funneled into that. There's one example, CDL and those types of things we all think about with commercial driver's licenses. But, whatever is meaningful for them so they can support their family, their new mission is often focused on that. But also, college isn't for everybody. But also, there are vocational skills that really translate well to a very nice income for them to support their family. So we're very much for that. And we hope that we are empowering these warriors to make whatever choice is appropriate for them.
Great. Thank you. Other questions, please? Sir, in the back.
Hi, Jack Pagano, a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel, served in Operation Iraqi Freedom, now COO of a major television station in Afghanistan. I admire what you're doing. It's great. There's donor fatigue in the United States. In Afghanistan, we have 150,000 wounded warriors, and they're left, excuse the expression, for dead. What do you do for donor fatigue? As you know, there are many organizations that are vying for the dollars. What are you doing to educate the 1%? 1% of the United States is only served. What are you doing to get the masses to help? Because if you don't help, you can't get your job done.
All right. Yes, we're very passionate about that because it takes a lot of donor dollars to run very complex life-changing programs that we focus on. So to that donor fatigue, it is important. We feel it's very important to keep the public awareness up in this country for these challenges that our warriors face who sacrifice so much for our country. And so when there aren't active maybe images of the continued combat that's going on, we invest in that, in making sure that the public is aware of some ongoing challenges for our warriors that we serve. But it's absolutely imperative. We don't take any government funding, no federal or state funding, so we are completely dependent on the generosity of the American public. We have over $7 million or 7 million donors across the country, and so we're very grateful to them. How we see Wounded Warrior Project is we are an extension of Americans who want to help those veterans who gave so much in service to our country. And so we make sure that we spend those donors' dollars wisely and transparently and on the most impactful programs. And so that's why we're so passionate about this data. What are the warriors telling us that the biggest challenges are, and how can we help them really thrive? We kind of think of ourselves as a healing organization. We listened and said, okay, so many have these invisible wound challenges, the mental health, the anxiety, depression, and post-traumatic stress. We have to, it's our duty to invest and innovate in those areas. And that's why we've developed so many programs in that area. But keeping that message to the general public isn't always easy when we're talking about mental health and stigma and veteran suicide. And so we are constantly challenging ourselves in the area of public awareness. But it's very important that the American public knows that that these problems or these challenges don't just solve themselves, and we need to put action towards that in organizations like Wounded Warrior Project and many other great organizations. We can be part of that.
Another question. The gentleman back, and then we'll go up after that to the gentleman in the tie in front of him.
Hello, my name is Peter Press, and I'm a Marine Corps veteran and also Wounded Warriors alumni. I attend a lot of events that you guys throw, and I think you guys do a great job. My question is like, I see a lot of different veterans in different economic classes varying, right? And there's, and earlier you mentioned something about a mentoring program for other warriors that don't have the education or know-how to navigate through some of the benefits. My question to you is, do you guys have any programs available or in development for other Wounded Warrior alumni to help each other out and you know, navigating through the complex VA and education system?
That's a great question. We have a peer support group model where we train warriors who want to be mentors to other veterans, and we train them to facilitate groups and also run events if they're passionate about having that type of empowerment. And so we have over 50 groups across the country. We specifically try and think of these wonderful veterans who want to be mentors as force multipliers. We have over 25 offices across the country, but we can't be everywhere. And so if we've got passionate volunteers, our warriors who are willing to dedicate their time to that, who doesn't? Veterans rely on each other to navigate whether it's the benefits process, the job market, whatever the case may be. And so if we can harness that, that's great. And so we invest fully in that in our programs and see that as a really important part of what we do. So we'll get you information about our peer support program.
And if I could augment that as well, because I think it goes beyond just those, the technical and tactical and the kind of that mentorship, but the social connection that comes from that integration. We've seen repeatedly that the more that people feel connected, especially warriors, the more positive the mental health outcomes are. And that includes a reduction in the suicidal ideations, which we saw earlier and talked about as being a significant concern. So not only is there that opportunity to learn from each other, but just that connection is so influential as well.
By the way, before we go to the next question, let me follow up with one more, too, and it's sort of a combination inspired by the last two. I'm hoping that we can, here at Brookings, talk you folks into having another event next year on what candidates should be advocating and proposing to take better care of our veterans than we are today. But to sort of maybe foreshadow that kind of a conversation, where is the biggest gap today in terms of what we're able to do for our veterans? Because a lot of what you're talking about is a happy success story about how you're reaching out to people and the Veterans Administration is reaching out to people much more effectively than ever before. The GI Bill, there are a lot of good data points, and yes, there are troubling realities about mental health care and physical injuries and unemployment, but some of that's probably going to be just, you know, innate to the severity of the challenge for the individual. But at a policy level, what can we do better that we're not doing yet? Do you need to grow? Do you need even more support, even more donors? Do you need greater consciousness in the country? Do you need the federal government to play the role of Sherpa or mentor that right now NGOs are doing? I mean, is there a list of one or two or three big things that you would put before us? You don't have to give it in great detail today. Maybe we'll do that in the future. But where do you see gaps, despite all these successes, despite all these happy stories? Where do you see gaps in the services that are being offered to our veterans population?
Well, you did a great job identifying those. I would say we focus our priorities on our advocacy efforts, really focus on increasing access, whether that is for warriors who are trying to access mental health care, being innovative about the nature of that care, telehealth, whatever can, if it's a rural area, being open to making sure that they can get services in their community. All those things related to the Mission Act and others, they're very important so the warriors can get care where they are, particularly mental health. But the same challenges exist when they're trying to access physical health. If we can get them into care, whether it's, when I say through the VA system, that could be at a VA facility or in their community and using different options through choice, et cetera. So that's important to keep the warrior at the center, and then what is most impactful for that particular situation. Transitions are a problem, and making sure that we try and be innovative about that. Getting them transportation to care is really important. If the best care is a facility that's in Oregon, but the warriors in Texas, how can we get them there? And being innovative about that. And so we're really passionate about that. Women's issues is something that we're focusing on. Access is a huge problem for them, as they've told us, and we want to make sure the populations that seem to be most at risk, and that is one of them, as the VA has said, their suicide rate is higher than men, male veterans. We want to make sure that we're helping change the environment so that it can be greater hours of access and more welcoming. So those are a couple areas. Toxic exposure is something that we're very much focused on. We have been able to bring together a team of 19 organizations to focus on getting them health care right now. Over 70% have said that they've been exposed to hazardous materials. Only 9% are getting health care right now. So if we can get them care right now and then support efforts for more research, that will be great. But they need some health care right now.
Anything you want to add to that, Melanie?
No, and just to supplement with the women's issues, one of the stats that I think doesn't paint the most productive picture, but the importance of women's issues and why that is a focus, is the rate of military sexual trauma within our population. Again, that wounded, injured, and ill, but four out of every 10 female veterans that are registered with us had encountered military sexual trauma during their time in service. So importance of recognizing the support that's necessary with that, being able to get to the mental health resources to help them work through those challenges so that they can live the most productive life on the back end of that. So I think that augments what Jen said.
Thanks for your patience over here, sir.
Hi, Ryan Bridge with Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. I'd seen that you had measured both social isolation and community engagement in your survey. Could you talk about any cross-tabulation between one's sense of belonging, sense of purpose, and their overall health and well-being? I see this as one potential avenue that we're really missing here. No matter how good one's mental health care is, if they don't feel welcomed in their society, they're not gonna do well.
Absolutely. You highlight something really important, is that those elements of isolation and involvement, and one of the findings in the report shows the limited number of individuals that are registered with us that are willing to go out and interact and socialize within their community without their caregiver. So that's certainly something that is a potential barrier for maximizing, as we talked about just a few moments ago, the benefits that come from that connection. The cross-tabulation, absolutely. This initial report that we have here, and I'll put this out as a call for any subsequent insights, is digging more into the data. We've got a 100-plus page report that's sitting with each of you today, but that just scratches the surface. So organizationally, we've invested in expanding our efforts to be able to dig further into the data and look at where are those meaningful correlations across factors that we know have significant relationships. So over the next year, we'll be continuing to dig further in, and I'd love the opportunity to talk with not only yourself but others that have an interest in some of the specific subsets of the data. And for anybody that is interested, the reports for not only this year but also the previous 9 years are all available online. So again, happy to talk more about that.
Other questions? We've got about 10 more minutes. Please, here in the front row.
Thank you. Josh Goldberg from Boulder Crest. First of all, thank you for this, and each year you do this. It's meaningful, and I'm sure it's a ton of work, so I appreciate the contribution. This is a question that goes to what was talked about earlier about access, which has traditionally been the hypothesis, is if veterans get care, especially in mental health terms, we'll just focus on, then good things will happen, then good outcomes will be seen. And what's interesting that I'm reading, and it's a lot of stuff to go through in a short period of time, but it looks like the stigma rate is only about 32%, and that a lot of veterans are going to mental health, are seeing specialists five times. And yet, I mean, the numbers are woeful, right? The depression, and we're not just talking like PTSD, we're talking severe, like well above clinical thresholds PTSD, which would, at least in my inference, and I'm biased, is would suggest that the system isn't the panacea that we think it is, and that just that getting access to mental health care in the current approach isn't working very well. And like I said, I know I have some confirmation bias on this, but my sense is that the data is saying that, and I just, or are saying that, is just wondering if you could speak to that, and in that context, when you speak about, you know, Warrior Care Network and the other work, what does that innovation look like, and how does that innovation then come back into the VA to make those 5.6 visits actually meaningful and not solve every problem, but at least get people below massive levels where they're not going to leave their house because their struggles are so vast?
That was a lot. So I can see that's... I can speak to in the Warrior Care Network. So what we see, and I know, given your role, you're very passionate, I'm sure, about evidence-based care and then care that really works and what is working for that warrior. So what we do is we try and, again, I'm going to mention transitions, but we get the warrior into care. It's a disease of avoidance. And so if we can get them into care quickly and into very good care, it can be a great situation, but you've also got to have follow-up after that care. So our Warrior Care Network is a 2 to 3 week intensive outpatient program. They receive a year's worth of sessions in 2 to 3 weeks. That's great. That's wonderful. First, you got to get them to say yes to care. They've got to clear their calendar to get 2 or 3 weeks availability. And then afterwards, what are you doing? We integrate the family into that model to make sure that they know what they're going back to. We integrate in the VA into that. So, I mean, we've got that system is big, and most of our warriors are using it to some degree. So getting that follow-on care both within the VA and then other partners where they can get good outpatient therapy afterwards after this great intensive program is something we're passionate about. We see that that's a great, when we then measure those results of resilience, the PCL5 afterwards, 100 days afterwards, a year afterwards, they're maintaining. So they start really severe. They get to a really great level after the 2 to 3 week program. But what are they doing, you know, 100 days after, 6 months afterwards? We see, yep, it rises back up a little bit, but they're more functioning. It's less disruptive for their life. So to me, groups like Boulder Crest or groups like Cohen Veteran Network or Centerstone, whatever, in Headstrong, whatever is going to work for that warrior. We're part of, you know, whatever collaboration is going to work, because that referral between organizations, maybe what you all are offering is working for, you know, most of them, but those that need something that is back in their home, maybe it's telehealth, then let's get the answer for that warrior. So that's why our reach as a group, as a collective group, needs to be so strong. Maybe you can speak to some of the data you talked about, but that's kind of how we see. We want to meet the warrior where they are and get them whatever care works for them. Could be through the VA. It's not the panacea, I agree, but it could be through other organizations as well.
From the data perspective, we saw early in the video that the rates of mental health injuries like PTSD, depression, and anxiety were at the 70 to 80 plus range. When you then drill down and look at their current status within those, we're seeing that it's approximately 60% are in that severe category of PTSD, and approximately 40% have the severe depression. I think the opportunity to drill down and look at of those individuals that are at that extreme level for both PTSD and depression, where are they relative to accessing care? Have they been the ones that are endorsing the barriers being more impactful? Are they the ones that are of the 50-plus percent that have sought treatment, or are they the outliers that haven't seen that? So I think that's really that next-level analysis.
We'll go to the woman in the back and then come back here for a follow-up.
Hi, my name is Liza Lieberman. I'm with Mazon, a Jewish response to hunger. We're a national anti-hunger organization, and we're really concerned about the rates of food insecurity among veterans. I'm noting some of the employment survey questions that you asked as well, and just wondering if you can speak a little bit about the interplay of some of the work requirements that we're really concerned. I mean, we unfortunately have heard some really tragic stories about someone with a veteran with a disability who maybe their disability is recognized by one of the state agencies, but maybe not the state SNAP agency, for instance. And we're really concerned that the U.S. government needs to be doing more to connect veterans and, frankly, currently serving military in some cases as well, to benefits like the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, formerly known as SNAP. Can you speak a little bit more to that dynamic?
I can speak to what we see in terms of our emergency financial assistance approach, which oftentimes is related to either shelter or food in terms of insecurities or just the need, an emergent need. We invest over $2 million with an internal team and then through another group, Operation Homefront, to make sure that we can listen to what the warriors need in those really emergent situations and get them assistance. In terms of our So we offer that, and we see it as an issue. And you're right, just it also for currently serving. But it's something that we feel we try and make them stable, their financial situation stable, and then make sure that they've had their benefits looked at to make sure that they are in receiving all the benefits they're entitled to. And then also, if they are employment ready, get them that job, not just a job, but hopefully a career, but get them some stability for both the warrior and the family member. We have lots of examples of warriors kind of coming in with, we had one in Colorado recently where it was a young couple with two young kids living out of their car. It was a point in time, the last month had been just one thing after another that really led them to homelessness. And so we were able to working with a couple other organizations, but thankfully they walked into our office and we were able to get them that day a hotel for 2 weeks while they got permanent housing and those types of things. Organizations who are adaptable and flexible to me are really important for these scenarios, whether it's homelessness or food insecurities, because frankly, you're not the Titanic. You can move on a dime. It's great to have good advocacy in these areas, but a flexible agency on the local level is really important for homelessness and food insecurity, in my opinion.
Come back here, and then probably have time for one or two more after that. Do you have a follow-up, sir?
My follow-up, I think, was exactly to your point on the mental health side, which is, as big as you guys are, and we're relatively very small compared to that, we're still not $8 billion budgets and so forth. So ultimately, the purpose of philanthropy and nonprofits is to innovate, figure out what does work without the normal constraints, and then tie back into bigger systems that address issues to access, the way in which people feel treated, the degree to which they're connected to others. And I guess my question is from, because you guys wear a lot of hats, is from an advocacy perspective and a mental health perspective, what do you think, and it may be a better question for our next speaker, is what's the tie back? What's the ways in which the work that's happening at Mass General Rush and Emory and MGH and Odyssey and Talk and the other work that you do with your partners, how does that tie back to make the system better? Because ultimately that's where most people are going to go to get their care.
Absolutely. So I feel like I planted you because that's a really great question that, like, for our Warrior Care Network. So there's some great innovation that has happened because we've been able to innovate and work with four world-renowned organizations and develop a model of care that I think is advancing mental health care specific to PTSD. So we've created a great model with lots of great outcomes that we want to give back to a system that can scale it, because as great, and we are investing $250 million in Warrior Care Network, that can be budget dust for some other budgets. And so take it back and be able to scale it so more warriors and family members can take part in that program. That's ideal. That loop back, yes, we want more of that. In the programs that are appropriate for the VA and other governmental agencies, we should do that. Have philanthropy innovate and then take it back.
We'll do one more question, please, and then we've got Dr. Lawrence here. What I'm going to suggest after our next question, I did promise you a break. I don't want to completely break my promise. So what I'm going to do is half break my promise. I'm going to suggest that anybody who doesn't really need a break just maybe stand up and stretch while we do a changing of the guard. Anybody who wants a refresh to their coffee, please do it quickly, and we'll resume within about 5 minutes with Dr. Lawrence. But please, last question over to you, Tom.
Thank you, and thank you for everything you do for our veterans. Really appreciate that. My name is Tom Burke. I'm a federal executive fellow here, but I'm also active duty military. And one of the challenges that I've had and other military leaders have had over the years is making sure that we understand the actual nature of the problem with respect to PTSD and depression. One of the interesting phenomenon that we noticed over the course of our military career with multiple deployments is that the soldiers who most often manifested depression and PTSD, et cetera, were not those, curiously, who had actually been in combat, who had actually been on the front lines, if you will. What we discovered is that a lot of the folks who were having issues may have deployed to combat but weren't actually fighting, if you will. They may have been on a combat outpost or on a forward operating base, or sometimes never deployed at all. So I'm wondering, so this is sort of a curious inversion of what you might expect the evidence to point to. And I'm wondering if you could speak to that and to the sort of the broader point of diagnosing the problem. Is the problem typically associated, in your opinion, with having seen combat and the belief that PTSD results from that? Or is this a broader societal problem that's worthy of exploration, not just simply through the Wounded Warrior Project, but with other agencies? Thank you.
I'll start. I do think it's a broader issue. I think in the general population, rates of anxiety and depression are up. It's definitely something that, and that's where people who serve are from the general population, right? But what we see within our population is over, I think, 93% have deployed, some of them to combat areas. But, you know, obviously there's different ways to serve within that combat zone. But at the same time, we see that sometimes there's delayed onset PTSD from a traumatic experience that could be due to service or other situations. But what we try and focus on is, okay, so they served post 9/11 and they have a diagnosed condition. Usually many of them who identify that is a diagnosed condition, whether it's PTSD, anxiety, or depression, and we treat them. And oftentimes there's several traumatic events in their history, sometimes pre-service and sometimes during service. And so I don't think we get everything was great in K-12 and then they went and served and then stuff happened downrange. That, yes, but then also sometimes they come into the service with varying coping abilities, various support networks. And so we deal with who we have in our area. And I think that's very common yes, I think it's a larger issue, but I do think there's definitely complexity when you have traumatic experiences in an environment of combat. And so that is something that we need to make sure our providers are culturally competent and that they are absolutely using innovative care and world-class care for our veterans who gave so much.
And just to supplement that, I think the complexity of various issues. PTSD, anxiety, depression are not unique to the veteran or the population that we serve, nor is obesity, nor is homelessness. It's all of those factors when they come together. I think the uniqueness of that and those that we're serving amplify the potential implications of that. So as we continue to go forward and dig further into the data, is really being able to see those interactive effects, because I think that's really where we're seeing the uniqueness of those that have been wounded, injured, or ill as a result of their service.
So we'll take a quick break now, and then I'll briefly introduce Dr. Lawrence. He'll give some remarks, and then Dr. Clancy and I will have a follow-up discussion. But please join me in thanking Jen and Melanie. So thank you for your kindness in complying with my very abridged coffee break. It was very cruel of me. I apologize. But I'm thrilled that we're now moving to part two of our discussion, which I think will be every bit as interesting as part one. And we've got sort of a two-part act within this, starting with Dr. Paul Lawrence, who is an economist who has studied at Amherst and Virginia Tech. He is also a retired Army officer. He is also a distinguished author on management. And he currently is the Undersecretary for Benefits at the Veterans Administration, where he oversees 24,000 employees and a budget of more than $100 billion a year, underscoring the point made here earlier that there is, for all the importance of Wounded Warriors Project, an issue of scale as to the different roles that can be played realistically by the NGO community versus the federal government. Dr. Lawrence has been in this position now as the 7th Undersecretary of Veterans Affairs for Benefits. And in just a moment, I'll trade places with him, and he'll give some remarks, after which he'll have to leave. But Dr. Carolyn Clancy, who, like we say in my family, he's the kind of doctor like me who has a degree. She's the kind of doctor that can actually get you better if you're sick. And she is also an important official at the Department of Veterans Affairs. And we'll leave a fuller discussion of her role to the conversation that she and I will have after Dr. Lawrence speaks. So please, without further ado, join me in welcoming Dr. Lawrence to Brookings.
Thank you for inviting me to what I wrote in my schedule as the first event in kicking off Veterans Month. So thank you very much. And I'd be remiss to those who serve much longer than I actually didn't retire from the Army. I fulfilled my ROTC requirement. But I imagined it would be a career, which is why I went to airborne school. But the woman who I eventually married when I served in Fort Lee, Virginia, said, "I'm moving to Washington, D.C. If you go to Fort Bragg, you're on your own." So I thought that was when God intervenes in your life. But it's really great to be here. I love interacting with Wounded Warrior Project. I really consider them a class group. I've really enjoyed my experience with them. I was excited to come again to the survey, and I have to admit I probably would have showed up in the audience had I not been invited, because I remember last year's conversation really well. I enjoy working with the staff. They're thoughtful and creative, and one of the things I've really liked about Wounded Warrior Projects is one of my priorities that I've come in when I've been in office is to really be collaborative, to think about all the groups that can help veterans and work together, and they've been really great collaborators, and I think the sign of a good collaborator is they'll whisper in your ear, "That's a really bad idea," and not tell anybody. So they've been really good at that and waved me off on a couple of things, which I thought were really good, and I'm glad I didn't say them out loud. But it's really great to be here. As the introduction indicated, I'm really a data geek, and so I really would have stayed for the survey. And it's great because, as Dr. Clancy knows, Mr. Wilkie, Secretary Wilkie, talks all the time to us about VA not being governed by anecdotes, but to really have the data to understand what's going on so that we make thoughtful and informed decisions about how we go about serving veterans. And so when I read about the things that were going on in your survey, I really got excited because those are the many things we talk about at VBA. What are the outcomes that we're trying to achieve, not just the processes and the spending of the money, but what is it we really want veterans to have at the end of our time together? I read about, it's an impressive 33,000 participants in the survey. We're running a survey right now. Our survey rates are much lower. I hope there's no staffers here. We tried real hard, but this is really impressive. And of course, you know, following the journey of Wounded Warriors, since they're such a significant part of what we do, is really important. Learning their habits and where they are and how they convene and what they do are really, really important in the delivery of benefits because, again, it isn't just getting the benefits, it's helping them work through the journey. And what's really important coming out of the survey is the value of education as people seek to improve their life. So the survey really helps me understand the journey, and the journey helps us figure out what's going on in VA and how we continue to evolve to be there for veterans. And why this is so important is we continue to think about evolution and transformation at VA. And it's sort of ironic because we've been thinking a lot this year about it. This is the 75th anniversary of the GI Bill, right, the Servicemen's Readjustment Act of 1944, which set in motion so much of what goes on for veterans. So in thinking about that, we spent a lot of time talking about the education benefit, right, the opening of college to essentially most of America. And just want to let you know, if you think about what took place in the early 1940s, by and large, our country was rather uneducated. I did some research trying to appreciate why the access to college was so important. And if you took 10 people in the United States in 1940, 7 had gone to high school but had not graduated or gone to something close to high school. 3 had gone to high school, and one of those 3 had gone on to college. So by the time we're entering into World War II, we're virtually uneducated by what we think about now in our country, right? So education opens the door to college for essentially almost the rest of America, no longer seen as a privileged thing, but one that would educate our broad group of people in the United States. And Peter Drucker, management analyst, a smart guy, talks about the Servicemen's Readjustment, the GI Bill, as the most transformational thing that happens in the 20th century, opening us to being a knowledge society and realizing the value of that. And why it's so interesting to think about isn't the middle class and the creation of wealth, but I leave you with the observation I thought about a lot as I studied this last year or earlier this year when we were thinking about it, is because it right in the middle of this was the 50th anniversary of us landing on the moon. And I think you saw all the time the pictures of the big control room where there were huge screens like this and people sitting at terminals, generally guys, that's how it was, right? Men sitting at the terminals looking at stuff, right? And you had to say to yourself, that's 1969. That's 25 years after the law passes, right? Where did all those scientists come from? The computers, the statisticians, the physicists. We were virtually uneducated 25 years ago. How did we land on the moon? A lot of that has to be the GI Bill. So you can see the head start it gives us in education. The other thing that's not much talked about in the GI Bill is the second part of the benefit, which was the no money down home loan, which at this period of time was virtually very hard to own a home. In fact, for those of you who are a little bit older, you might remember that you had to put 20% down back in the day, and saving for a home was a very, very hard thing. And I will personally tell you that one of the things I really found valuable about my service was finally getting my DD-214 and knowing I now could buy a home with no money down, well ahead of my peers, and this was only some period of time ago, right? So that sets in motion a whole series of things, and you want to have a sort of funny thing to think about. The next time you're at a mall, a shopping mall, I want you to think about the GI Bill, and let me explain the connect, right? So when there are now home loan guarantees, there aren't a lot of homes to buy, right? No one's building homes during the war when people come back, and many people were living with their parents and access to a home to buy because they weren't really being built. Well, a former Navy CB, William Levitt, figures out that what he learned in the Navy was really very valuable. So he buys huge tracts. We're talking thousands of acres of lands in Pennsylvania, plows down the trees, and knows how to build low-cost tract homes. That becomes known at Levittown, and thousands of people live there now with the home loan that they got from being veterans, right? Well, to access those roads, to access those communities, the suburbs, as they would become known to call, we had to have roads. And once we had roads out there, needed shopping things, and that was the creation of malls. So you can very well be in Tyson's Corner and say, if it wasn't for the GI Bill, there would be no shopping malls in the country. It totally transforms our country. So it's really transformational things. And so why we think about that all the time is because Secretary Wilkie now talks about what's going on at VA as the largest period of transformation since Omar Bradley's time, which was right after the war. And it makes some sense if you think about what we're going through. Since the start of this administration, there have been a series of laws and initiatives that have really set in motion some profound change, and I'll share quickly with you what's gone on. Since 2017, there have been 4 laws and 1 initiatives that are really changing what we're doing for veterans. The first is the Accountability Act, which gives us the opportunity to remove habitually bad performers. You see the president talk about it when you happen to see his remarks. He said, I came in, passed this law, and now I can say you're fired. That's a brief summary of what the law can do, but it's mostly for the habitually bad performers, and that's very powerful stuff because you could imagine Secretary's primary initiative is provide good customer service to veterans. One of the ways you do that is you eliminate people who have no idea what good customer service is. So that's really big stuff. Coming out of that were two laws, appeals modernization and the Forever GI Bill, which I'll talk about in a minute. After that came the Mission Act, which changes the way we provide care to veterans, offering them more choices, as well as being able to study the location of hospitals, as well as even attracting medical professionals by reducing their loans and things like that. And finally, the creation of a joint electronic health record between us and the Department of Defense. This will be an incredibly painful process to go through, but it will be really, really valuable, and I think it's estimated to take 10 years. But when we can have a seamless record and a seamless journey from being a service member to being a veteran, this will be great for the folks who understand how benefits work. Part of why it takes so long is we have to go find your medical record, and often we can't. Now we'll be able to get it right away, and in a perfect world that I envision, we'll be able to look at you before you leave, forecast what your benefits might likely be. You were in the tanks. This is what happens to folks who are in the armor. This is what's going on. So it's really very powerful stuff. The things that affect VBA, the appeals modernization and Forever GI Bill. Appeals modernization is going quite well. This gives you the chance. Remember, a lot of VA is kind of unique in the sense if you don't like our decisions, you can appeal them. Well, it used to take between 3 and 7 years, depending if it was a good day, to get your appeal through the process. Now with appeals modernization, there are lanes you can go through to get your decision resolved quicker. That's what you choose. In the VBA, we process two of those lanes. Those are going well under the 125 days we're required by law to do. And the Forever GI Bill, again, the continued expansion of the education part of the GI Bill, passed in 2017, rolled out in little piece parts over time. We're in about ready to implement the last part of that on December 1st when we deal with the housing allowance. But it created things like high-tech apprenticeships called Vet Tech, more education if you get involved in STEM, really interesting things for our veterans as their educational experience changes. So this transformation that Secretary Wilkie talks about is really very powerful, backed up, of course, by tremendous support from Congress. Secretary sort of politely points out to the cabinet, I think he tells us, that we continue to get budget increases, and the VA now has its largest budget in the history from wherever as we support veterans in the way that folks want to have us do. So I guess I would point out that, you know, we depend a lot on partners like Wounded Warrior Project, not only for the good advice, but for being there when we do think about stuff. But we also, like Wounded Warrior Project, I mean, I think they are good, very good at holding themselves accountable. We donate money. What do you do? How are you helping the veteran experience? At VBA, we conduct a quarterly webinar or webcast about the results. I'll do that tomorrow if you're interested. JP at the back of the room will leave you a card with the website where we talk about the results of our business lines. In many ways, I think about VBA as a financial institution within government, right? We do loans, we do insurance, we process claims and the like. And it's fair to think about how are you doing with that? How are you processing? How are you running the program? So tomorrow at 2 o'clock, I'll give a quarterly as well as the end of the year report on how we're doing. And just to give you a spoiler alert, we had a really good year. We met or exceeded all our targets. Those are imposed by us, but also some oversight from Congress as well. So that's what we'll talk about. And quite frankly, and maybe at Brookings, you guys can tell me the answer to this. The results are so good, I'm raising the targets because I think we're better than what we can do. So veterans will get more from us in 2020 than they got in FY19. And that's on our own volition because, quite frankly, the team is so good and we know we can do more. In fact, we've gotten so jazzed up about that after being in office for just over a year or so, we realize a lot of the problems and the headwinds that have caused us problems no longer exist. Some of the internal things we had to work through as well as some of the statutory things that we were able to overcome. We're going to announce tomorrow that we're going to think about FY20 as what it would mean to be our best year ever. And of course, since the people who do this are all so young, we're calling it hashtag best year ever, as to what that means for not only service to veterans, service to our staff, engagement with our staff, as well as engagement with partners like a Wounded Warrior Project, because we think that that's what Secretary Wilkie's talking to us about when he says, you know, customer service is my prime initiative. So that's a quick overview of what's going on. Oh, just one last thing. So December 1st is the implementation, the final part of the GI Bill. That's a promise we made last year when we had to reset because of some technology problems. And January 1st, we'll begin adjudicating claims for Blue Water Navy. It's a law President signed into effect on June 25th. And just to clarify, the law allowed the Secretary to stay decisions until January 1st, and that's what he did, so we could do the preparation for how you actually process these claims, not the least of which we're getting 28 million records from the National Archives of the ship logs that served off the coast of Vietnam. But we are processing claims now. It's simply the granting that will take place on January 1st. So to the extent there's been some confusion about that, we know the Vietnam veterans average age is 73, and they are waiting for this, and we'll be ready to go on January 1st. So that's a brief overview. I have to leave. I'm sorry, but Carol and I, Dr. Clancy and I just talked, and so she'll answer all the really hard questions. So that's the deal we have when one of us goes first. But I guess I would conclude by sort of, you know, making note of sort of what we are approaching, right? So if you're a veteran, and as you heard, I'm a veteran, you know, thank you for your service. If you're a family member, a veteran, and I grew up in an Army family, you know, thank you for your support. And, you know, gee, if you have friends maybe in your organization that have job openings and like, I'd urge you to really strongly suggest they hire veterans, you know, as I hope you realize and hope others have emphasized today, when we support veterans, America wins. So thank you very much for your attention. Thanks for squeezing me in your agenda.
Well, welcome to Brookings, Dr. Clancy, and thank you for joining us.
A pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I wanted to really just pose a couple of big, broad questions and let you react to where we are in the conversation and, more generally, any thoughts you have on the state of veterans today in the United States and things you think we should know about. So I want to ask a big, broad question to start. But I wondered if, before that, you could tell us a little bit about the position you hold at the Department of Veterans Affairs and what it means to be Deputy Undersecretary for Discovery, Education, and Affiliate Networks, if I got that right.
You have it exactly right, and if you actually paid attention, it spells Dean. So I tell a lot of people I am the Dean for Veterans Affairs. I almost have the secretary trained to say that. But the VA has some very, very important academic assets, which means that we're constantly focused on some of the problems that this survey and other sources are surfacing and trying to figure out how do we do it better. So today, and yesterday through Friday, we have researchers meeting over at the Washington Hilton from all across the country, and they are presenting their work on pain management, on improving mental health care, on a whole host of issues, and not just sort of the what to do, but how does it work in our system, because that's really the holy grail. How do you build a learning healthcare system in such a way that we figure out not just how to do a good study, that's great, but what's the best part is to actually figure out how do we work with our partners in operations to make sure that it not only gets implemented in practice, but wherever a veteran shows up seeking assistance, even if that's on the other end of a telehealth connection, they're going to be getting the best care possible. So we have research Most of our facilities, we think all but one, have some effort going in teaching the future health professionals in this country. Now, the partnership with the nation's medical schools goes back to just about the end of World War II. So General Omar Bradley, and we will celebrate the 75th anniversary next year. We're really looking forward to that. But to put it in bolder terms, we support one-third of U.S. medical residents every year, and about 70% of practicing U.S. docs have had some training in a VA. So we have a big impact on future health professionals, and it's not just docs. It's nurses, it's pharmacists, it's physical therapists, fill in the blank, and we're probably training those folks, which is wonderful. And the third piece is healthcare innovations. So we've taken a page from the Wounded Warrior playbook and partnering with a lot of entities, which is another big theme of Secretary Wilkie's, is partnerships, trying to figure out how do we do it better. So just to give you an example, we recently had a hackathon with MIT's Hacking Medicine program, and it was over at Samsung's building down by Eastern Market. So, you know, all these eager beavers, I thought they were staying overnight. Now, I have to say, I was a little disappointed. They have to leave at 11 and, you know, go someplace to sleep and then return. But nonetheless, they were all busy trying to solve problems. While I was there, I met someone who had won a prize before, like in the past year or two. And he's come up with, he's got a company and a way for a veteran with diabetes to step on a particular pad and the temperature difference where a foot ulcer might be forming can actually alert that veteran's providers that they need to take action to prevent, hopefully, the occurrence of foot ulcers and, really importantly, to prevent amputations and so forth. So that's the kind of work we do, and it's very, very important, but we're not stopping now.
Fantastic. I wondered if you had any other thoughts, reactions to what's been said today. Most recently by Dr. Lawrence, but more generally, I guess the way to frame the question would be, how would you take stock of where we are today in the United States in handling the challenges facing the veterans population? Where have you seen progress? Where are you most concerned about unmet need?
Sure. So where I've seen progress a lot is in access. Some of my colleagues and I published a paper right at the beginning of 2019 looking at wait times in our facilities compared with private sector wait times in about 15 major metropolitan areas. Now, it turns out, notwithstanding our places where we had big backups in wait times like Phoenix, because our facilities had not caught up to where veterans were moving and so forth, and we had a little tiny bit of telehealth going on, but now we have a whole lot more. In the private sector, at a very high level, we were about the same. Since then, we have improved a lot. And for the most part, the private sector has not been moving as rapidly. So I think access is better. And more to the point, we've put a big premium on same-day access today if you have an urgent primary care or mental health problem. Now, that may or may not involve your getting in the car and coming over to the facility, right? Sometimes an urgent problem is you were supposed to fill my meds and I didn't get them. Can you check that it should come by today? Or if not, how do I get an emergency supply? And so forth, or I need a form approved, or something along those lines. But the point is, that's probably 20-22% of all of our appointments, so I think access is better. There's a growing number of studies that show that the quality of care we provide is equivalent to or better than the private sector. So when, you know, the RAND Corporation or a researcher from Dartmouth does this, I put some faith in that, right? We can do these studies, but it certainly feels like it has more validity if an external group produces those results. And I think those are probably the biggest areas. Can we get you timely access to safe, high-quality care? Do we have problems? Yes, we do. Do we have problems that are not seen in the private sector? To the very best of my knowledge, based on my prior life before I came to VA, no. What we have is far more transparency. That's completely fair for a publicly financed system. But and this is not to scare everyone, but I'm just to say that, you know, what happens in our academic partners, medical centers and so forth, or any private sector facility does not get that same level of scrutiny. for the most part, it's actually been a good thing for us. So I think those are where the big improvements have been. The one other advantage, and this ties back to Dr. Lawrence directly, for those of you who care about healthcare, I mean, in a policy sense, you know, one topic that people talk about a lot are social determinants of health. All things being equal, if you have lower levels of education, lower income, housing problems, and so forth, your health is going to be worse. And guess what? Even if you run right into Dr. Oz or, you know, the best doctor anywhere, that's still going to be a tougher set of challenges, whether that's paying for prescriptions or the best kind of, you know, meter to test your blood sugar or whatever it is. It's harder if you've got those problems. And for those problems, we can provide a lot of support for veterans through the GI Bill, you know, through employment assistance and a whole host of services. So we see the Benefits Administration as pretty vital partners. Unmet need, I would say we have a mental health crisis and a suicide crisis in the country. Thankfully, it's gotten far more attention among veterans than the rest of the population, but I think the rest of the healthcare system is slowly coming to grips with this. You hear about this in the clinical community because there's reports about burnout, right? People feel like this is not giving me a great deal of meaning. And it used to, but it is not anymore. That's one manifestation. At a time when we have insurance parity, there is still a huge, huge stigma with mental health care. So we have an executive order now where we're focusing on suicide prevention, not just for the veterans we see. We do that, of course, but for the veterans everywhere. And frankly, we're going to need help of Wounded Warrior Project and many, many other groups to try to figure that out.
On that point, the Wounded Warrior Project, of course, focuses primarily, or I think exclusively, on the post-9/11 generation, and that's pushing 4 million individuals, I believe. But I think there are more than 20 million veterans in the United States still alive.
Yes.
Are there certain problems that you see more often with the Wounded Warrior Project population, so to speak, with the post-9/11 generation? Or, for example, is the risk of acute mental health distress and suicide, is that evident across all veterans' demographics?
Well, we know that among veterans, the largest number of suicides is in the 55 to 74-year-old age group. The highest risk, though, is 18 to 34, and I would guess that's mostly going to be the veterans for whom Wounded Warrior advocates for specifically. We are now at a time of, getting where we have an all-volunteer army. One of the issues that we struggle with in healthcare, and every healthcare organization struggles with this, is, let's be honest, 18 to 34 or younger than me, are far more tech savvy. And frankly, they don't get this, come to the waiting room and hang out with your buddies and we'll get to you. And, you know, you'll be very pleased when we do get to you, but, you know, we don't have that much respect for your time. You know, they're much, much more hip to virtual modalities. And, one of the people who works for me, who is a constant source of insight and intel, you know, more or less tells me with the demands on his time, he's raising a son by himself. Occasionally he's got another job on top of his day job. And he'd like an app for when he's going to the DCVA to tell him how the appointments are running. Well, you know what? I'd like that too. So far, my provider doesn't seem all that inclined towards getting it. But, you know, when you can sign up for doctors online with ZocDoc, you can do this now with VA as well. Why shouldn't we have that kind of capability? And frankly, I think younger veterans put a much higher premium on convenience. I get that. There's only 24 hours in a day. And if you've got a lot of demands on your time, that's just how it's going to work. Thank you.
One last thing for me, and then we'll go to the audience for the remaining 10 or 15 minutes. And again, thank you so much for being here. This question's a little different. It's not so much a policy question, but I'm picking up on the mental health issue. And I wonder if there's a message you would want to give to anybody who might be listening and experiencing mental health distress, who's a veteran or even not a veteran for that matter. Is there a message about what's the first step? You know, what do you do when you're in that moment? If we have this national crisis, but we do have capacity to help, what do people who are experiencing, you know, the worst of their lows or their anxieties, what do they need to hear from a healthcare provider?
Well, first of all, if you're in crisis, I would want everyone to know about our crisis line, which is 800-273-8255. You might want to put it in your phones right now so you'll always know it. So it's 800-273-8255. I think, and you don't actually have to be standing on the ledge, metaphorically. If you feel like you're in crisis, it is a great place to call. And I've been extremely impressed for veterans enrolled in our system, as well as others, how quickly we can reach veterans literally almost anywhere. Several years ago when I was acting undersecretary for a year, I actually started getting emails from veterans that said something like, you know, I don't know this person, but I saw him on my Facebook. Can you help? And the answer the vast majority of the time was, yes, we can help. We can figure out where this person is, and, you know, because we are a very large integrated system, and that's a great capability. I think if there's one advice I would have for everyone sitting here and everyone you know is don't be afraid to ask people about it. You know, again, that's the one manifestation of stigma we all deal with. It feels like a little too sensitive to ask someone, gosh, you're seeming kind of down to me, like how down are you and can I help and so forth. Sometimes that feels too private to people, but, you know, people get that message, you know, non-verbally, right? And so they don't bring it up with colleagues and so forth. And it is never, never really the better idea not to talk about it. I mean, so if you are worried about someone, tell them. Even if this is the furthest, if, you know, actual suicide is the furthest thing from their minds, no one is going to mind that you say, I care about you and I'm concerned. If the unthinkable happens, not talking about it is horrendous. I've had it in my immediate family, and frankly, what I felt insulted about were people who didn't want to say anything. I know they thought they were being very polite and concerned about me, and therefore the politer thing to do was not to talk about it. What do you think I was thinking about 24/7? You know, the recent death. And so those are what I would want, and that we want to help. And if you have ideas or gaps, please let me know. Carolyn.Clancy@va.gov. One of the issues that I'm working on in particular is how can we help people in the workforce, actually deal with their own mental health resiliency, dealing with emotional stress and so forth. And a growing number of employers are starting to get into this, which I think is phenomenal. But in particular, for those who deal with the public, which may include veterans, right, how do they recognize signs that someone is, you know, in a bad place? Now, sometimes Dr. Lawrence's people, right, are hearing from veterans who say things like, I am so frustrated with your system, I could kill myself. Now, often that is a figure of speech, and sometimes it's not at all. And trying to figure out how they can do that, how they can recognize that and express concern and assure someone that there's help available. And again, any veteran with an acute mental health problem, regardless of whether they're enrolled in our system, as long as they have not been dishonorably discharged, can come in and we'll see them right away.
Thank you very much. Let's go to your questions for the remaining 10 minutes or so. And again, please wait for a microphone and identify yourself if you could. Got a gentleman over here, please.
Hi there, Dr. Clancy. I'm Rajiv Ramchand from the Bob Woodruff Foundation. One of the results from the Wounded Warrior Project survey that I'm struggling with is this 70% of respondents report exposure to toxic substances or hazardous chemicals of the post-9/11 era. I'm curious, is the VA, I know that they have a registry, has the VA made headway on what those exposure, what diseases and illnesses those exposures might contribute towards or increased risk for? Do we know that? And then this finding that 9% have sought care, I don't know whether that's a good or bad number. Should veterans who feel that they've been exposed to toxic chemicals seek care, and what should they be asking their provider about? I don't want to put you on the spot. I don't know the answer to that. But.
No. I'm really, really glad you brought this up. Yes, we do have a registry specifically focused on those individuals who have had some exposure to burn pits, and we're learning a lot about it. So you've got two things going on. One is a sizable number of people who've had this exposure, some of whom are experiencing some difficult lung problems, right? Now, we still have a lot to learn with how much of that is primary from the burn pits, how much of it is exacerbating some underlying problems that at best were minor to trivial before they entered service and so forth. And we won't stop till we get some of these answers, and we have some really, really terrific people working on it, both within VA but also outside as well. At the same time, right, that's true. What else is true is that many veterans, particularly in the 9/11 era, and it's funny because it's a reflection of medical success in the battlefield, right? The mortality rate has been dramatically lower than in any prior wars or conflicts. That's the good news. The slightly less good news is that people come home with more, the medical term is comorbidities, right? That could be the form of serious bodily injuries, and it could be so-called invisible wounds. And this leads many people to wonder, is all of this stuff related to toxic exposures? We don't know all the answers, but we won't rest until we do. We're working with the National Academy of Sciences and doing a lot of research internally. In fact, our executive in charge just asked for a full briefing on this, and I was exhausted just looking at all the information we have. And so it is a very, very big focus for us.
Thank you. Gentleman here in the 10th row or so.
Good afternoon, Dr. Clancy. Greg Nemhard with the American Legion. You touched on some really good points about what the VA is doing and the advancements in scheduling and access and everything compared to the private sector. And I use the term we because we veterans are really good at spreading bad news about the VA. We have often succeeded in doing that very well. I have a lot of veterans that come up to me and say, I don't go to the VA because of this, this, and this. And a lot of times it's because of something they heard from somebody else, not even their own experience. Programs like what we're doing here, Dr. Lawrence's updates, these are really good things about getting the good word out there. Have you been able to measure just how well these are doing, how much we're getting the word out about the VA through programs like what we're doing here?
I'm going to say this as diplomatically as possible. I can't say that that kind of communication is one of our strongest assets. Coming from VA. So to the extent that your organizations can help us, that's greatly appreciated. But you know what? You learn a lot when people complain. And we're so acutely sensitive to that that in all of our facilities now, we do something called V for veteran signals, right? Where we're getting a lot of real-time feedback. Now, some of this is about predictable things. I had to wait for 15 minutes, or that clerk wasn't as nice as he or she could have been, and so forth. But that feedback gets to the right place, and we deal with it. And sometimes it's surprising. You know, in one network, they got a lot of complaints about pharmacy, and we're sort of surprised and almost a little hurt because they thought that was an area we did very well. And come to find out, there were some serious glitches, and they fixed them, and that... But, you know, that kind of real-time feedback and reporting is only as good as the service recovery that goes with it. So, really, we have put a very strong focus on that. So, when people complain to you, I would tell them to let us know, and we're happy to deal with it.
Anyone else? Time for one or two more, if anybody would like. Ma'am, right here. We'll make this the last question.
Kate Watson, Your Next Stage. We focus on women vets. My question is, and maybe there's an answer out here and I haven't read it yet, are you finding, what are the difference in clinical outcomes from those things that are social media driven, for example, telehealth versus high touch? Is that something that you're looking at? Is there some data out there that I could get a hold of?
You know, that is such a fantastic question. I can't say that we're actively looking at it now, but we need to. There's no question about it. Of course, we're excited that we had 2 million encounters last year with veterans via telehealth. And in fact, I love this. Last week in Eureka, Montana, you know, at the local VFW hall, they now have this special booth. It looks a little like the Mamavas at the airport, if you've seen those. I don't think that was intentional, but the point is that it's private, where veterans can go there for a telehealth encounter. And, you know, so in areas without broadband access, widely available and so forth, you know, this is something of a godsend. But we still have a lot to learn about when it is far, far better to be in person and when telehealth is just as good. We have a lot of evidence about mental health. You know, so someone from the University of Washington not long ago and worked with us a lot to make sure that we had mental health providers in all of our primary care teams across the system. He told me that one of the residents he thought was one of the best he ever trained was now serving veterans in Amarillo, Texas, but he was not giving up his views of Puget Sound, where he lives. And increasingly, we're going to hear that, but thankfully, there's been well over a decade of very strong evidence that that works well. For other kinds of issues, I think we're still learning. At the same time, we're partnering with an organization, for example, that uses a doctor and coach duo, and it's almost all virtual, to help veterans with diabetes. And they're seeing some pretty dramatic results and improvements, which is not a problem healthcare has excelled at, right? Because it's not easy. Hey, nothing to it. Just to forget everything you really want to eat and exercise like crazy. Anything else? I mean, right. But, you know, with that kind of coaching and motivational approach, that seems to be working. So I think that we have more to learn about the relative strengths and limitations of both.
Well, let me thank everyone for coming today and thank Joe and Melanie and Jen and Dr. Clancy and everyone else, Dr. Lawrence, and all the veterans in our communities who have done so much for the country and all their families and friends who do so much for them and for all of us. So best wishes, go Nats, and have a great rest. Happy Halloween.
And thank you all. And thank you all, please, from the bottom of my heart for everything that you're doing. It's hugely important.